heading into the home stretch here. Welcome to day 23 of the Everyday Novelist 2020 NaNoWriMo Write Through. I am your host, J. Daniel Sawyer. I am joined by your co-host,
Kitty Nakian.
And our panel of beleaguered writers, we have
Tori,
Alexis,
and
Gail Carriger. Hi.
You were distracted by Nori.
I was distracted by Nori. I was having a moment. The seaweed and I were commuting, and now we've stopped. Sorry, everybody.
It's a beautiful thing. I cannot express my jealousy in strong enough terms, or my envy, I suppose. Important distinction between those two. How is everybody doing today? Tori, how are you?
I just woke up, so I'm going to go right back to sleep when I get... I'm sorry. I'm here.
Okay.
I'm so tired. What was I doing?
How
I
many
got
words
180 words.
Okay, so that means you did...
over that, but 180 words I know for sure.
All right, so that'd be 94...
I like 15. Watching you do math. It's better than me.
Ah, that's 80 words. 95, 15.
Okay.
Good. All right. Hey, you're almost over 10,000. Getting close. Well, I hope that you have a pleasant sleep after we're done.
I will literally pass out as soon as this is over.
Well, how about you, Alexis? How did you do today?
Let me add this last part to the count. 5,847.
5,847. 209 words today. Cool. How about you, Kitty?
I cheated again. And
you evil, evil person.
Because I'm still integrating, and I have 7,110 words as my final.
1,144 words today. How about you, Gail? How goes the end of the book?
It's done, and we're 79230.
79230.
So just under 80, which is good.
Not bad. How much do you think that will grow as you do your revisions?
I think I need to do the pass on the last chapter, so that usually grows anything I write by about 500 words just naturally on a second pass. And then I need to edit the whole thing. I'm slightly dithering over that at the moment, so there's a sort of epic dither happening over what I want to do with this book. So. But I think I will probably just edit it without a strong pass. I have to think about it. But how many did I do today?
You did 1,130 today.
Okay, cool.
And I topped out today at 48,832, which gives me 2,435 words for today. Which isn't bad, but isn't what I wanted to hit. If I'm going to finish this by the end, I need to start pulling in some 4,000-word days here, because... So, hopefully tomorrow I'm actually going to... I think I've got another shift in me tonight, so that'll give me more than one shift for tomorrow's writing, which I've been having trouble securing lately. But, I'm just about to kill my second character. Well, my second character on the ship. It'll be the third death in the book. I've also revisited the Earthside storyline and have introduced another layer of blackmail into the situation, so...
Excellent.
I now have suspense going from both ends to push
coils
on the middle.
Coils within coils!
And one of the people who's being haunted has just admitted that she's being haunted to someone else, and Ooh. So that's about to become an issue.
If you have a lot of layers of blackmail, does it become lacquer?
Oh, boy. Yep. It's that part of the month.
So, do we have a question from the forum?
God, I hope we do. Otherwise, this one's going to be real short.
Wait,
Let's see.
I have something vaguely to say. So, okay. I'm not accustomed to writing characters from this time period. I keep on trying... subconsciously to write male characters that respect female characters, even though that's not, like, historically accurate. But I don't know how to navigate a social world where that doesn't exist.
It's not so much that that didn't exist, but that men respecting women will look different in each society.
Okay, okay. Mm-hmm. Right.
Maybe thinking about it as men respecting women isn't the right way to phrase it. Every society has codified within their customs appropriate ways for men to interact with women, men to interact with men, women to interact with other women, women to interact with men, and adults of either sex to interact with children of various ages.
All right.
So think of it in terms of what a person like your character is. The person fundamentally decent, fundamentally deceitful, fundamentally moral, and how closely that person would hew to the cultural customs of what's accepted and appropriate behavior.
The other thing to keep in mind is that there's two different kinds of respect. There is the kind that is felt, and there is the kind that is shown. And in an informal society like ours, the two get collapsed most of the time. You tend not to show respect to people you don't feel respect for personally. Whereas in more formal societies, but in those situations where you do, you show respect based on what little of a formal script of interaction we have, not based on your personal feelings.
Yeah.
So in more formal societies, the divide between what you feel and how you are expected to act can be quite wide. And respect is...
It's so cool! Sorry, yeah. I love, like, really stricter form, like, from a writer perspective, I should say, I like really strict formal societies. Rule-bound societies are extremely fun for me.
Oh, they are.
They sound especially confusing. Because,
well, they can be to someone who didn't grow up in one, but...
But when you learn about them, they're not confusing, and that's the point, is there are rules governing everything, and so you always know exactly how you're going to behave, even if you hate the person. If they're older than you, and you are Thai, you must use P. Like, there's no... You have to say, I would... Dan, are you older than me? I can't remember. I might be the oldest one here.
No, you're like a year older than me.
You all would have to call me P. Gale, because you are all younger than me, and you would all have to call me that... Simply because I'm older than you, whether you care about whether you respect me or not, and it is a formality of language, and it is a sign of respect, and just
Kitty's
because
older
I'm older.
You.
Oh, Kitty's older than me? P. Kitty. Yeah. Sorry, Kitty.
I'm ancient.
Sorry, P. Kitty.
Yeah.
But in those situations, if you have a character who desperately wants to express their dislike for a figure whom they are obligated to show respect for, they will do it between the lines. They will live up to the formalities in a fashion that makes it clear that they resent having to
do
it.
Well, yeah, Cole.
And if they don't, like this one drama I was watching, the younger character knows another character is older than him, and he drops the P, and I literally went, ah! Like, he also punches him in the face, but it is way more insulting that he dropped the P than that he punched him in the face, because I was like, so shocking. He used rude language. It was shocking.
Yeah. If you want to get a really accessible idea of how this works, watch some military films.
Military. Mm.
Because military has very strict rules about how you address senior officers, and you can tell by the way someone says, sir, what they're actually thinking.
So good.
And occasionally...
Or Victorian period dramas, like how people are
Victorian
introduced, all that sort of thing.
And when we say watch military movies, please don't include the science fiction series Stargate SG-1.
No.
Because that drives military people
insane
and children of military people. Especially after the first two seasons. After the first two seasons, they just like fuck off with this military protocol. We're just a bunch of scientists and the guards of the scientists, and that's all. We don't follow military culture.
But back to like the original gender dynamic thing. Like there are things that the sexes once did to show respect to each other, even in American society, like tipping your hat or offering a lady your arm to cross while she like goes down the stairs, or I mean, and there were all sorts of formality of things like
holding the door, pulling out the seat.
Or having a hat pin in your hat to stab people.
Right, like a gentleman precedes a lady downstairs, but he supersedes a lady when she's walking upstairs. Like, just, like, weird rules like that that are kind of partly, like, attire-based and stuff.
Well, what's weird is that many of them have, like, rational bases in a previous, in an age gone by.
Or they've been ascribed rational bases post hoc.
Yeah, that's true.
Says the girl who runs up against the insults to porcelain with tea pouring protocols all the time, where I'm constantly being like, no, the pottery didn't crack.
Do you have any advice for writing a character that is, I don't actually know the social norms that well. This is really challenging. Is it obligated not to show respect, or not obligated to show respect? Are there...
Oh, would be almost always obligated to show respect.
Other way around. Not the POV character.
Who is lower than her socially, or...
No. Was that... Not the POV character. Someone higher than her socially that admires her.
Well, he might use, or she might use respect... under those circumstances to indicate their admiration.
All right, so that wouldn't be considered,
Right, so,
No.
Not if it's done delicately. Like, so you might show, like, more politeness to someone who's lower than you if you're interested in them kind of, like, emotionally or sexually or whatever. You might treat them more like an equal in order to indicate your interest.
The actual
word for that is condescension, which doesn't mean the same thing anymore. But the word condescension originally meant to display respect to someone who is of a socially lower station that would be due to them if they were of a higher station than they are.
Damn, that's the opposite now.
Well, the reason it's the opposite now is because Americans don't do...
like it.
Americans don't like thinking there's anyone who's socially higher than them, so when someone socially higher than them acts as if they are, they find that insulting.
Oh, okay.
But also, like, so you could, and a good quick way, a quick hand way of thinking about this is an adult who treats a child like another adult.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, we'll, like, crouch down to be on their level, we'll talk to them in a normal tone of voice without, you know, like, that is a kind of condescension in the original sense of the word. And usually kids respond really, really well to it because they love to be treated like adults,
So, Specifically treating them like a kid. Like, you're drawing emphasis to the fact that you're taller than them.
No. Well, you kneel down to meet them on the eye level so they're not having to look up at you.
If a tall person did that to me, I would feel very condescended, not condescensioned.
You would now, but you wouldn't have, and in fact I know for a fact that you didn't, when you were 7.
I was a very agreeable 7-year-old, in my opinion.
But to a 7-year-old, the fact that the adult is taking the time to come into their world and include them as a peer is a big deal.
That's interesting.
I mean, it's a complicated thing. Like, how would you feel if a man held the door open for you?
Depends on the man.
Like, at one point, it was expected that if you presented as female, that a man would hold doors for you.
Yeah, and but if he didn't, like, and regardless of interest, if a man did not hold a door open for a woman, it was a major social faux pas and would damage his reputation.
Interesting.
But now it has all this added complexity to it and stuff like that. But it's the same. There's the same kind of complexity going on with social mores in all cultures, ancient times or today.
Have, like, any advice on doing better research on this? Because I'm doing something wrong. My keywords don't match the articles they give me.
Gail would be the person to ask for social mores research for ancient Greece.
Unfortunately, John Romer is the only one I come up with, and he's Egypt. It is not a time period I have written in because it is would require too much research.
Oh. But that's okay.
But I would read. I mean, you can read Homer or something like that. But I would read modern fiction author who's doing works set in ancient Greek times well, Madeline Miller. Or another great one is further back in time, but is Mary Renault, who both are her historian, but are both have excellent historical.
Mary what?
Renault. R-E-N-A-U-L-T. Last of the Wine is, as far as I'm concerned, her best one. But it's the Peloponnesian War setting. And she's very comfortable to read. At least I find her very fun and easy to read. She has very choppy sentence structures, which I really enjoy. And then Madeline Miller is Circe and The Song of Achilles.
I've heard good things about those, but I haven't read them.
Both of which are excellent. Cool. And she's a rather Spartan literary writer, but again, easier to read, I think, than you might expect, and manages to convey culture without baggage in terms of, like, descriptive baggage. Hmm. Like, you really get a sense of being in time and space with Miller without it being, what's the word, worried at. Like, it's not chewy. It's not overly florid
or anything.
No, it's none. And yet you're still like, oh, this is ancient Greece. And part of that is a handle on the cultural interactions. Nice. Although Circe is the one that has the most women characters in it, so you might be best off reading Circe, which is also the one I have not read. Both Renault
that one
and,
is from Madeline Miller, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's her name, right? Circe, Madeline Miller? I want to say that's her name. I feel like she's the scion of Mary Renault. I feel like they're very, like, Madeline.
And we will, of course, put all these links in the show notes.
Yes, I was right. It is Madeline Miller. Ha! Yeah.
What about
that would be my suggestion. Right. Sorry.
So nothing on doing my own research.
This is the consequence of being a writer, is like what the information we need is usually not the thing that's out there. You know, I'm sure there are books on social structures in ancient Greece, but like books that are like, how would people talk to each other?
Yeah.
And how, some authors have come up with them. Like Daniel, there's a great one for those who write in the Victorian and the Regency era, which is what Jane Austen ate and Charles Dickens knew, or what Charles Dickens ate or Jane Austen knew. I can't remember. I can never remember. Daniel Pohl. But that's specifically for writers who were writing in that time period.
Yeah, if you want to do your own research, you have to delve deep into books that are from academic presses, and those tend to be very expensive and hard to find.
Oh, all right.
And boring.
And boring.
Okay.
Unless you're interested in it, in which case they can be
true.
Riveting.
True.
I am interested in it, but I do get bored easily.
I would try Circe. It's supposed to be an excellent book, too. But at least, even if you just read the sample that you can get for an electronic book or something, you will get an idea of, like, how she's conveying social structure with her interactions between characters. And it should, like, nest you pretty quickly in time and give you kind of some tips and thoughts that, like, you can kind of, like, study how, put your, like, writerly brain on rather than your readerly brain and sort of study how she's doing it. And it might be helpful, at least sort of helpful.
Yeah,
she helpful. Might also list her sources somewhere, so.
Thank you.
All right, we do have some questions from the forums, unless Woo-hoo! Anyone has anything else.
Nope.
You awake, Tori? All right, we've got a trio of questions from Teresa that kind of all go together. Question one. I'd love to hear your take on subplots and parallel plots. Can you explain what each of them are, bearing in mind that I'm a person who has zero patience for reading about a goddamn tortoise crossing the road for a chapter and thus studied engineering and not literature?
Thank you, darling.
Question two. Are there specific problems that a subplot or a parallel plot will fix? And question three. I have been writing this novel in a fairly close third-person point of view following one character, and I'm trying to figure out how to get two physically distant characters some screen time. It seems a parallel plot might be a way to accomplish this. Without just changing to a different character's point of view, do you have any ideas on how to accomplish this? The only thing I've come up with so far is some sort of epistolary technique.
Ooh, well, that's a good technique.
Those are hard questions.
All right, let's take it one at a time. So, what's the B plots?
Yeah, what are subplots and parallel plots? Bearing in mind that I have no patience with stupid excess descriptions.
Subplots, B plots, and parallel plots. Right. So, I will call them B plots. That's the way I always learned mm-hmm. to think about them as. And for me, like, the best example of this is early Star Trek The Next Generation, which almost uh-huh. always had a B-plot.
Yep. It was a formal part of the series Bible. They had the A story and the B story.
Yes. Exactly. And B-Story was usually on the ship. It often involved the holodeck, and it was almost always about friendship and interpersonal relationships between the mainstay ensemble cast of characters.
And the A-plot was the mission for the ship.
And the A-plot was the mission and planet side and all that sort of thing. Often they will interweave with each other. It's best if they eventually do intervene with each other. Your B-plot can also be your romance thread if you're writing a non-romance book and you want a romance thread in it. That can be a B-plot. Your B-plot can also be your comedic plot. That's often the way it's done in television. So, I love a B-plot. I have B-plots in almost... I have multiple plots, but I love a subplot. Yeah, it's great. It's a great way to spin up a second set of characters, too, to that you're then going to...
You can also run different plot lines. In the same set of characters, you can run different plot lines for each of your main ensemble. And just your main character has more plot than the other ones. But if each character has their own character arc, character journey, and they're having experiences where the other people aren't always in the room, they've got their own plot.
Yeah. So one way to do this, if you're writing a deep POV third or first person, in other words, you don't want to leave your main character's head, is to just have side characters mention things that they're kind of doing or whatever. So, for example... I have a Z plot or an X plot or whatever, which is essentially a named character who appears for less than a paragraph in almost all of my books who just happens to be engaged to a new person in each book. So his name is Captain Festin Hugh. He shows up. Somebody mentions it. Somebody's mother mentions it. He comes up as a party escorting a new young lady. And then eventually he gets engaged to my character's best friend. Briefly, and then disappears again.
That's very PG like, Woodhouse of you.
It's so Woodhouse-ian. And then eventually he shows up like two series later, in actuality, or his final wife does. But he's like just constantly engaged with somebody, and that is like a minor B plot, a minor plot. But it's just like. And it's just mentioned by other characters. Mm-hmm. So that's one way to handle a B-plot. Yep. Another B-plot can be like, I have the main character. What's going on with her best friend? Well, the best friend is having this whole other life, but she's intersecting with the main character. The main character can use the best friend to convey information, but I can always use the best friend to convey some other adventure that that best friend has been on or is having, or, you know, like crazy shenanigans that she's getting up to. Yep. That's a B-plot.
And filling in backstory that happened before. Yeah, that's why I'm using my B-plots a lot for backstory in this book. Before I get onto that, though, someone who... I don't know if he pioneered this, but he certainly honed it to an art form. The bringing of the B-plots on through interlocution by walk-on characters was Shakespeare. Every Shakespeare play depends upon B-plot as through interlocutors. So if you...
Oh my God, think about Midsummer Night's Dream. I've just been thinking about Midsummer Night's Dream for a random reason, right? So Midsummer Night's Dream has the Oberon, Titania, and Puck, right? And then the lovers. So they have, and there's four lovers. So they're each out.
And then the frame story with Theseus.
Yes, and then the actor, the acting troupe.
Yep.
Right. So there's like multiple plots going on in Midsummer Night's Dream. Yeah, that's a Shakespeare, of course.
And they
yeah.
intersect with one character from another plot having to incidentally walk on during this plot and fill everyone else in on what happened since the last scene that the audience saw.
Yes. I would suggest it's pretty challenging. I mean, maybe suspense books, but it's pretty challenging to write a novel without at least one B-plot going on or something else happening as well as the mainstay thread. Now, the questioner is talking about picking up a new POV in order to cover a secondary plot. And you need to do that if you need to cover directly observable action that's not occurring in the same time and place as your character. Unless you have...
Or directly observable thought.
Right. Unless you have cameras and mind magic or something, right?
Yep.
So I have had to add in a secondary point of view narrators in order to handle a B plot because I needed to have my character in motion outside of England, and then things are going on back in England, and I need to tell those two things concurrently. She can't find out about them by delay, which epistolary does. But I mean, if you're dealing with email or something, you could put epistolary stuff or comms or phone conversations or that kind of thing that convey that sort of information about a B plot.
But other than some variation on the epistolary technique, voyeurism is really your only other option if you're not going to jump to a third POV. Whether your main character CCTV or your main character peeks in at windows or eavesdrops on around the corner.
Yes.
Which Agatha Christie used a lot.
Right. And if you're writing a spy novel, of course, very useful. But you need to swap a POV. I mean, this is interesting when you think, so this is where, film and television has the advantage over us because it is always, or 9 times out of 10, it is omniscient. And so, like, when I'm thinking about, like, Midsummer Murders, we talked about last time, or Cozy Mystery, or whatever, we can just jump from someone's room to someone else's room, and we don't necessarily have to follow Poirot or Agatha Christie. Yep. In some cases, we can even see the murder occurring at the beginning of the series, which, of course, only those two people were there. Nobody was seeing
it. And of course, it's worth mentioning that while third point of view close is fashionable, you can still do omniscient and do it very well.
You can.
And when it's done well, the readers don't notice.
It's true. My first book is written in omniscient. Yep. It's very common in Dickens always wrote omniscient. A lot of the early Victorian authors wrote omniscient. So what we would call head hopping.
And some of the things that parallel, you ask if there are specific problems that a subplot or a parallel plot would fix. Oh, yeah. Like writer's block. It's really great for writer's block. If you've run to the end of a particular thread and you've still got words in you and you want to keep going, but you don't want to have to get up from the computer and take a walk to sort of get the next scene loaded into your head, you swap to a different storyline and you write that storyline because that's been cogitating in the back of your brain while you were working on this one. And it can seriously increase your output, and it can also cover a multitude of sins, because you get the switch covers your, in my case particularly, your switch covers the compulsion to stick with the characters through the boring parts, because if I don't have a second point of view to jump out to, I often wrestle very heavily with, okay, do I telescope here, or do I just stick through the boring part to find out if there's something in there that I need to go to, or do I do a chapter break and a time jump, or what do I do? And if I've got another point of view to jump to, it's easy, because I can just jump out to something else important going on and then jump back in the next time something interesting is happening in the main story.
I was going to say,
if you're doing deep POV, I highly recommend naming the new, like making sure you drop name your new POV character at the beginning of your opening new sequence. Although we are forgetting the chronicler. So you can also use the omniscient chronicler, which is what you did, Dan, in Down from 10 in particular.
Yes.
Right, you would have these moments where you pulled back and there was this sort of eerie, creepy, because of the horror aspect of that book, there would be this eerie, creepy, like, ghosty voice that was
It was just an ordinary house, so far as anyone knew.
Exactly. But comedic authors do that too a lot. Yep. So I'm thinking about somebody like a memoirist like James Herriot or Gerald Durrell, who will use just like a description of a place, a comedic description of a house perched on a hill looking like a wet squirrel or something. And no one's saying that. No one's telling
that. And I'm doing that with the current book. And probably what's going to happen when I go back through is I've got this sneaking suspicion that there's going to be a lot more of that added in. Because I'm currently roped into third close POV switching because I want to maintain the tension for myself so that my experience is mirroring the reader's experience. But then when I go back through, I'm almost certain that I'm going to add in more of those zoom outs to really ratchet things
up. It is an interesting way to add. The zoom out is a kind of great tool for writers in general, because it's a way for the writer to sort of, when we were talking about lamplighting, it's the way for the writer's narrator, literally the writer voice, to commentary on their own writing, right? You can have this little like nudge, nudge, wink, wink thing. And also, it is a vehicle for tension, which is how Dan uses it often. I use it as a vehicle for comedy almost all the time.
And
so,
my main characters
are not funny.
Yeah, in both cases, the technical term is dramatic irony, because what you're doing is you're imparting information to the reader in a, at a time delay either before or after the characters know it. And that allows you to either build anticipation in the reader if you're revealing it beforehand, or build dread if the character knows something that the reader doesn't and you're just alluding
Harry
to
Potter,
it.
Harry Potter. Terry Pratchett's early Discworld books.
Yes.
Are almost head-hoppy, if memory serves. It's been a long time since I've read, like, Sorcery or Color of Magic, but...
Even a lot of his later ones, where he was a very head-hoppy guy.
Yeah, it comes off as head-hoppy, but essentially it's just that he has such a strong narrator voice. Mm-hmm. Like, it is Terry Pratchett telling you this story, and you never forget that. Yep. That it almost... That he absolutely doesn't do deep POV at all. He doesn't need to, and he doesn't bother. Yeah. Like, which has the side effect of me being like, I don't ever relate to his main character. Like, I'm like, Rincewind, whatever. Like, I don't know anything about Rincewind. It doesn't matter to me. It's all in how he is telling me about
style is very much Victorian fairy tale.
Yes, exactly. So you can do that with your book as well, in order to, just to answer the question, for B-plots.
Whereas Neil Gaiman does the same thing, but marries it quite often to a deep POV, and he transitions very well between the two in his narratives, especially in his books, starting with American Gods and forward. Before that, he did a lot more first person, more tightly bounded.
Yeah, you are going to be in trouble if you're writing first person for all of these tips.
Well, unless
Dan, do you write? Oh, yeah. I don't write first person.
Yeah, no, all the Lantham books are first person, and all the Suave Rob books are first person. And the unique thing for me about Suave Rob is it's the only series where I don't jump points of view. Never. It's the rule, because the whole narrative conceit is that Rob is telling these stories to a guy in a bar.
I didn't...
So he's bragging about his exploits over a beer, and so the grammar is all structured like it's just this one long monologue, so I can't ever get out of his POV. Lantham, on the other hand, the narrative conceit I've got going is that you're reading his case files that have been edited after his death by his assistant.
He died?
No. He hasn't died yet.
Okay.
I don't know if I'm going to kill him in the series or if it's just going to be like when he's very old and dies. but his assistant is quite a bit younger than him, so she'll outlive him anyway. But the conceit is that what we're reading are things that have been edited by her from his notes and case files. And so occasionally I'll have her interrupt and insult him, or complain about the stupid decision he just made. Or occasionally, there was one book in He Ain't Heavy where he actually is in a coma for half the book, and so I jump completely to her point of view for quite a bit of it. And it's all still first person, the whole thing.
I've seen tricks done where you mix your persons, too, mm-hmm. so...
I'm doing that in this book.
God, the Chronicles of Nado series, she has a third-person distance POV, what I call legend writing, which comes off a little Homeric, as if you're telling this tale around the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're not particularly intimate with the characters, as most of the chronicling from the main mostly from the main character's point of view. But there is a hyper-intelligent cat character. And the hyper-intelligent cat character is actually the chronicler. And so the hyper-intelligent cat character talks to you in I-personal at the beginning of all of the chapters, and as if she were like, well, now we're going to get on to this section where, you know, like, I got to tell you all about this kind of deal. And it's a really interesting technique. I've seen that done as well, which is a little bit like interrupting with epistolary stuff.
Yeah, I'm doing that in this book. The historian has the inserts. The historian has inserts, the characters have monologues where they're like talking to the reality TV camera, their personal logs, and then the bulk of the story is told in third person close, kind of fictional reconstruction based on, you know, by the chronicler based on the found records.
I tend to do swap POV. That's my style, especially for my longer stuff. So I will either, if I'm writing a straight up, like more solid romance, I will swap POV between the two romantic leads sometimes. A couple of times I haven't done that, but, and then I'll do swap POV in my adventure stuff in order to get different places and times kind of under the, and I will throw a new point at, like, my last book, I had two swap POVs and then I threw a third POV right near the end, which they tell you never to do. But I was like, oh, I just threw them both off the ship.
You can do one chapter or one even two paragraph section in a book from a point of view that doesn't show up before a sentence, and the audience will accept it. It just occurred to me that there is another way to do, another clever way to do the epistolary stuff. And that's the found journals.
Yes.
Finding letters, journals, and other stuff that isn't addressed to somebody, but is but the main character stumbles upon them and so is then immersed in someone else's point of view
as they're reading it.
Nice.
That's coming up for me very often.
And it's fun from a writer perspective to, like, jump in and out of these different techniques and play with them. And
you've been trying to jump in here for a while, Alexis. What were you going to say?
This episode is a little longer than I anticipated. I have a few other things I wanted to get to tonight.
Oh, that's okay. Lay it down.
Do you mind if I hop out?
Oh, you didn't mean the conversation, you meant elsewhere. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Good morning.
did that encompass most of the questions that she had?
Yeah, I think we pretty well slaughtered that question dead.
All three parts. There were three parts. I'm just worried we didn't hit everything.
Parallel plot might be the way to accomplish this, but how do you do it without changing the POV?
You have to change the POV.
You have to change the POV, or you have to do some variation on the epistolary technique.
Yeah, or omniscient narrator interjection.
Yep.
Like, the omniscient narrator, this is something that Terry Pratchett will do, will pull back way distance. The omniscient narrator will be, like, far and away in the uncharted backwaters of the infatuable spiral arm of the Western galaxy.
That's Douglas Adams.
Regarded on its own. Right, that's Douglas Adams. But, like, freaking Terry Pratchett does exactly the same. On Discworld, you know, where the disc is on top of a tortoise, blah, 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 blah. And then he, like, closes in on the character doing something, and then he'll yank it all right back out again. He'll be like, as you all know, Ankh-Morpork is ruled by a so-and-so, and so and so has a little yappy dog and blah blah blah, right?
Yeah, or Rincewind picked up the brooch. The brooch reminded him of this time, blah 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 blah. Or he didn't know it, the brooch was originally created by this ancient wizard and was imbued with magic and
Or I'll have a footnote. We're like, let's talk about lemmings for a couple of
minutes. His footnotes.
That's all the narrator. What I'm saying is, like, that's all the narrator doing all of that.
Yeah.
So you can pull your narrator voice out of the super concentration on your character to tell. It is telling.
Yes.
Like, Terry Pratchett is a tell writer. He is not a show writer. He is a tell writer, which is fine because it's hilarious.
Yep.
But it is telling. You have to pull back and you can tell something that's happening in a different place and time that perhaps your main character doesn't know or is soon to find out.
There are two different ways to do that technique. There's the omniscient tell narrator like you get with Tolkien. And then there's the tell narrator who, though unnamed and unidentified, is definitely a character. And that's what you get with Douglas Adams. The book in the radio series.
Well, it's The Hitchhiker's Guide, right?
But the narrator is a character with a distinct voice and a distinct attitude. And
I argue Terry Pratchett is the same. I think Terry Pratchett is a character in his own book.
No, that's true. That's true. He just doesn't hook me quite so hard, so.
Yeah, but you can use that technique.
For that matter, P.G. Woodhouse was the same way.
Well, he's iPersonal. Jeeves and Wooster, at least.
Really?
Almost all of his stuff is first person. Yeah, you forget that, don't you?
I forgot that. I really did forget that.
He is really worth studying, actually, he manages to do what Dan just didn't realize, which is he manages to tell a story as if it were an omniscient third-person narrator from first person.
Yes.
From an idiot first person, no less, who is unobservant and doesn't know what's going on.
Convey and yet a tremendous you, the reader, know everything. Yep.
It's amazing. It's quite remarkable what he can do. Jeeves and Whispers are all told in first person. I think Laughing Gas is as well.
Wow.
It's remarkable, actually.
Nice.
Anyway, on that note, so there are ways to do it. You just might have to change your voice. It might materially impact your voice as an author when you do this sort of techniques.
But that's part of the fun.
All
right, well, that should do us for tonight. You're done. You get to go have sushi.
Oh my God, it's sushi time. You're right. I have to finish my rewrites tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
Then I can have sushi. I'll have sushi tomorrow night.
Excellent.
Or maybe I'll have both.
Killing me. I can't get good sushi up here.
Unless we make it ourselves.
We've made some pretty good sushi the other night.
That's true.
There is an oh boy roll with my name on it.
Well, on have some masago for me. That's my favorite stuff.
Don't worry, I will.
Don't worry, I will.
All right.
Okay.
We'll see all of you guys tomorrow.
Bye.